Pro Se, Law 360's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Amber McKinney. On today's show, we're talking about the Trump administration's efforts to reshape the judicial branch. We're coming out with a big package of stories looking at how the efforts panned out and what to expect going forward. First, we'll be joined by senior reporter Ed Beeson to talk us through some forces that could slow down Trump's progress. Then senior reporter Jimmy Hoover talks with us about one district that's been overlooked. As always, I'm here with my co-hosts, Bill Donahue.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Lawson.
Hey, I mean, that's funny, because yesterday on Twitter, you referred to me as the great Alex Lawson, and I thought
did.
That was going to be
I
my honorific
too high a bar?
Going forward. I mean, right. Not to be like a total
I wasn't aware of this, and if we are putting it up for like a host's vote, I would vote against it.
Oh, okay. Well, we are a democracy here.
Yeah, I feel like you really need to stand out, Bill, and I'll refer to you as the great Bill Donahue on Twitter.
His Excellency.
But then are we both that? And then it feels less special.
Maybe you get to pick what your honorific is.
Your Majesty.
Yeah, sure. Then it's like an arms race of like additional titles like Game of Thrones.
Well, part of the reason you were referred to as the great Alex Lawson is because you've been doing a bit of a media tour talking about your topic of du jour, which is trade.
Yeah.
That's your beat, and there's been a lot going on.
It's been a wacky week.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised you are on the podcast with us today. You've had quite a day today.
Oh, yeah. 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 Our first news item is actually that my head is no longer attached to my body. I'm the first headless podcast host.
There's a lot of legal issues there.
It's wild. Yes, you're right. It's been a big week on the trade beat. President Trump is back on his trade hobby horse. He moved ahead today with some incredibly controversial tariffs. These tariffs apply to steel and aluminum imports. And the entire trade bar and the trading community has been in a frenzy for the past couple weeks over this. The duties were actually signed into law. Well, signed into law is a presidential proclamation that got signed today. And we got a little more clarity. It's not quite as steep as we thought. They're not quite as dramatic. But
still big news.
But what he really did was make it a lot more confusing, and there's going to be a lot of blowback going forward.
But so,
well, can we start with something that I know is a little bit of a pet issue of yours, but I just want to see if we can say it here on the podcast now. Alex, is this a trade war?
Oh, geez. I mean,
have we declared trade war?
Well, listen, this
well, explain to people why you hate that term.
Trade wars are definitely on the horizon. The dastardly Trade Federation.
I was going to say, are they
is mercilessly taxing the Naboo shipping routes? No, this is not the right thing. That has been a little. That's a pet issue of mine. I don't like saying trade war because it's like very bombastic and amorphous. Yeah. But the way this has escalated has been so unpredictable as to come pretty close to what people would consider.
So to rewind a little bit,
yeah.
Tariffs seem like a sort of boring thing that sometimes operates in the background, don't we? Sort of put tariffs on things all the time. I mean, why has this caused everyone to sort of work themselves into a lather?
We do put tariffs on things a lot in this country, but it is often done in a very targeted way and a way that is meant to address economic harms, unfair trading practices by our partners. And it applies to like one specific product at a time, often from one country at a time.
Because it's governed by a system of rules. And we
Yes. And so, but what's happened here is that the Trump administration reached way back into the history books. And longtime Pro Se listeners will recall that we talked about this almost a year ago.
Wow.
When this first started rolling out. But I think a refresher is good. So they reached back to this law from 1962. It's Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. And that basically gives the U.S. wide latitude to impose tariffs on the basis of national security, not to do with economics or industries being harmed or anything like that. It's to safeguard our national security. So the idea here was, you know, foreign steel and aluminum is flooding the market, and that leaves us vulnerable because we need our own steel and aluminum to build up the defense industrial base. This has been eyebrow-raising from the start, and then it got kicked into high gear last week when Trump emerged from this meeting that he had with the industry, which was thought to not be a venue for an announcement. And then he all of a sudden said, we're doing a 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum. And it's going into effect next week, which was today, this week. And then here we are. That's how we got here.
Markets took
a dive. Trading partners were angry.
Yeah, it got crazy.
Yeah.
So you said in your lead up a little earlier that that got narrowed a bit today. It's a murkier picture now, but things changed a bit. Can you tell us what exactly happened
today? I mean, see if you can stay with me here, because I know that the benefit of me doing this segment is that I am the ostensible trade expert. But the early returns on this is that, like, everyone is extremely confused. But I'll tell you what I know. So, like I said, 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. But there are caveats now. This was initially thought to be, and across the board, every piece of steel and aluminum comes in gets this tariff. But there are caveats now. First of all, Canada and Mexico are not included in these tariffs.
At all.
At all. They're out. Okay,
got it.
Except...
And that is like kind of a temporary thing.
Right, because didn't Trump and the White House say something like...
In the proclamation.
But NAFTA.
Yeah, well, we are currently renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement, and Trump earlier this week tweeted, oh, you know, we're only going to remove these tariffs for you if you give us a good NAFTA deal. These two issues are not remotely related at all. This should be noted. But he even kind of backed off of that. They're out of it for now, and he says, you know, we're going to continue to have a dialogue with Canada and Mexico. NAFTA is going to be a part of that. So they're out. But also, there is a clause in both orders on steel and aluminum that basically allow for any country. You know what? I'm just going to read it because this is a breathtaking bit of legalese. Any country with which we have a security relationship,
mm-hmm.
is welcome to discuss with the United States alternative ways to address the threatened impairment of national security caused by imports from that country. Should the United States and any such country arrive at a satisfactory alternative means to address the threat of national security such that I determine I will remove the tariffs, is basically what he said.
Okay, so do other countries now have to basically, like, it's like petition the king for him to remove the
tariffs? The few trade lawyers that I've talked to in the hour that this has been on the books are extremely confused. Basically, yes, this sets up a system where government, I mean, this is a government-to-government thing, so governments will be asking for an audience with the president and say, hey, look, we're not that much of a security risk to you, right? Like, you can give us a break.
And there's no objective threshold for what puts you as a security risk or doesn't, right?
No, I mean, the statute, like I say, is over 50 years old and is written extremely broadly. The U.S. has a lot of discretion to make that determination. The other thing to note, though, beyond this government-to-government thing, there is also a separate process for individual companies to make product-specific exemptions. So if you're making steel in Germany, you can petition the Commerce Department and say, hey, I need my cold rolled, you know, rods, you know, exempted. So, like, the Commerce Department is going to be flooded with these individual tariff by tariff line petitions.
So, like, Trump came out a week ago and said 10%, 25%, done. And now it sounds like that seemed so simple. I mean, it seemed very draconian, but very simple.
Yes,
and now,
exactly. Yes.
And now it is so confusing.
So is this like the watered down version that folks, the sort of traditional free trade folks, have been able to get from them?
You would think so.
Right.
And that was certainly the intent, because since this announcement was made, Republicans, the Chamber of Commerce,
and Gary Cohn stepped down. And...
All the usual free trade types were like, you know, this needs to be more narrowed. Like, if you hate China so much, let's like aim this at China a little more. There's no need for this wide ranging stuff. But now, like you say, it's this weird patchwork and it's all this conditional, hey, scratch my back, maybe I'll remove these tariffs. And the early returns from Capitol Hill, Republicans on Capitol Hill are still extremely upset. Like, they just like, this is still, you know, going to do bad, you know, damage to the economy.
So,
and to the extent that you've tailored it, you need to tailor it more.
And let's talk a little bit about this national security bit.
Yeah, it's important to get back
because
to.
Because that's what the White House is saying these are predicated on, that it's national security. But everything that's come out of Trump's mouth essentially has been about just the economics of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, I mean, the conventional wisdom is now that that's even further undermined this national security argument by what they've done today. Like, if it's really a national security, you know, issue, how can you be comfortable making all these concessions and caveats, right?
Sure.
Like, I mean, how pressing can the threat be? Trump said this quote today in an attempt to thread this needle. The tariffs don't go effective for at least another 15 days, and we're going to see who is treating us fairly, who's not treating us fairly. Part of that is going to be the military. Who is paying the bills? Who is not paying the bills? I have no idea how this articulates a security standard. To put a more finer point on it, you're going to see legal blowback. For a long time, I had written off any chance of a U.S. Court of International Trade suit here because, as we've talked about in many contexts, U.S. courts give wide deference to anything based on national security. But as we're talking about here, the administration is being so brazen with its, you know, you know, playing with this national security standard that I talked to a couple lawyers who think it's definitely going to get revisited.
So that's like a manufacturer that uses steel would bring.
Oh, yeah. Right. Importers who want a competitive marketplace, sure, for their imports, people who make other things. Yes. And so you could see that take root. We've seen that kind of manifest in litigation over the travel ban and the transgender, right, ban, where Trump's own statements come back in a court proceeding, mm-hmm, to question stated motives of policy. A lot of threads here. A lot of strands.
You'll be busy.
A lot of strands to keep in old Alex's head. But I'm detached, though it is. I'm going to stay on it. So we'll see.
Thanks, Alex.
Yeah.
Alex, similar issue. I've been meaning to ask you. I mean, do you know if there's aluminum or steel in an Academy Award, in an Oscar statue?
I don't know. But if there is, it just got a lot more expensive because there are some considerable tariffs in place.
They're not in a Prosy trophy.
It's true. The Prosys are made
solid gold.
Out of granola bars.
I was going to say they're made out of air, but we clearly couldn't decide on a bit, so we're just going to forge ahead.
All right, so this last weekend were the Academy Awards, and I think maybe the biggest moment of the night was when Frances McDormand got up on stage and sent everybody to their computer to Google the two words, inclusion rider.
Yeah, it was like a great speech. And then, like, now that I know what it is, it was a very worthwhile thing for her to talk about. But it did make for, like, an incredibly, like, awkward, like, TV moment.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I've got two words for you.
I know.
A thing you don't know what
it
is.
Well, a bunch of people tweeted, like, what is an inclusion writer? Like,
right, oh, yeah.
Sure. But so as in the week since, you know, even today as we're recording, the issue of inclusion riders is picking up steam. We wrote a really good story about it, so... let's talk about it.
Well, why don't we answer that question for anybody who didn't Google it?
Sure, you go. Yeah.
What is an inclusion rider?
So we have talked a lot that in the last 6 months to a year as a nation about the ideas
of
inclusion and diversity and trying to prevent a lot of the bad stuff that we've heard come out in the, mm-hmm, last 6 months.
Yeah.
So an inclusion rider is meant to be sort of a concrete way to do that if you are a person of power. Where, you know, it's not just you saying nice things and saying, I wish this kind of stuff didn't happen. It's a clause that an actor with negotiating power can ask to be put into their contract. The same way you have a rider that says you need X, Y, and Z in the green room, you can put a rider in there that, mm-hmm, says, if I'm going to be in your movie, you need to make a good faith effort to hire more women, more people of color, and more people from other historically sort of underrepresented groups in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And
so it's like a way to leverage power. For
it's a way to put your money,
yeah,
where your mouth is.
Yeah.
That if you're Matt Damon, you know, and you're out there talking about how you support this movement, put an inclusion rider in your
sure,
contract the next movie you make. The concept was brought up for the first time in October 2016 at a TED Talk by a woman named Stacey Smith, who works at the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative, which sort of studies the diversity issues in Hollywood studios.
And I know Sam, you mentioned Sam's story. He talked to some lawyers, and I know this obviously it's a contract,
sure,
thing, so it has a legal history. Let's walk through that.
Yeah. Sam, our business of law reporter, Sam Reisman, had a really good story about Kalpana Kotagal, a civil rights attorney and employment attorney at the firm of Cohen Milstein, who was sort of integral in taking this from, you know, a TED Talk concept to a, yeah, reality. So
people say anything at TED Talks. You gotta put your nose to the grindstone.
So Smith, the woman who gave the TED Talk,
yep,
Kotagal, met her, mm-hmm, shortly before the TED Talk, and in 2016, they and a few other people sat down to really start crafting language that could be put into actors' contracts.
So let's talk about that language. How exactly will this work?
Yeah. So she, in her story with Sam, I felt like made a point to say that, like, this isn't gonna say if you have 50 actors on set, 25 of them have to be X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The idea was more to create a framework for productions to the way that you interview people, the way that you audition people, with more of an objective to like reach these goals rather than having hard numbers. So
it's like an efforting,
right,
issue.
And that sounds super wishy-washy, but the idea is that it's aimed at so you don't have to. It's aimed at smaller parts that,
yeah,
that aren't,
sure,
necessarily reliant on the race of the actor. And it's based on, again, the, you know, below the line production roles where you can really make an effort to find people who would be qualified, who maybe in a traditional casting situation wouldn't be picked. And some of these contracts can have financial penalties for studios that don't do these things. 'Cause,
mm-hmm,
that's the immediate question that comes to mind with a contract, you know, like, well, I mean, what are you going to do? So it has these sort of triggers in there that if things haven't been done the way that you want them to be, there can be financial penalties.
So this all sounds great on paper and in a speech at the Oscars, but is anybody actually doing this?
Well, today news came out that Michael B. Jordan, who is one of the big stars in Black Panther, which is the big movie right now, making bajillions of dollars, he came out and said that he's going to use these things going forward, both in movies he's in for his production company. So it's, you know, it's...
Which makes sense, because I don't know if you've seen Black Panther. The women in that movie are by far the best part of it. So it makes sense that he would take that to heart.
Right. And so it's a big, you know, it's to so quickly, it would be easy for everyone to sort of forget about the Frances McDormand moment, but for so quickly for it to go from the abstract in an Oscar speech to someone really coming out and saying, here's a concrete example of a big, because Michael B. Jordan's a big star now, of him saying, I have power, I can make this happen in my movies going forward.
When President Trump took office, conservatives were hopeful that he would reshape the judiciary. He's made good on a lot of that promise, with his first year in office setting a record for the number of circuit judges appointed. But is he really going to reshape the entire judicial branch? Law 360 reporters have done a deep dive on that question, and we're joined today by Ed Beeson, who's going to talk us through some of what's going on. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
So the first thing I want to do is sort of set the scene. What has Trump accomplished over the last year?
Right. So I guess it's important to note that when he came into office, he had this tremendous number of vacancies to fill. Obviously, one on the Supreme Court, and that's one he filled. And he's filled about 14 circuit court judges over the year plus that he's been in office. And 12 of them were in his first year, and that was roundly noted as a record by a first-term president.
And as Amber mentioned up top, I mean, this performance and just the Republicans taking over D.C. has led people to eye up more, over the next maybe 3 years, maybe 7 years of, like, what lies ahead. So what do Republicans see out of the rest of the Trump administration in terms of judicial appointments?
Well, I think it's twofold. I mean, one, it's getting more judges in place who follow the originalist and textualist model of jurisprudence, pioneered by Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas.
Right.
And also young judges who can serve for decades to come, like Justice Gorsuch.
And they're also expecting or hoping for a big percentage of turnover in the judicial branch, and Trump being able to fill a large proportion of that.
Right. So one of Trump's advisors on judicial selection, a fellow by the name of Leonard Leo, he told me that hope is that maybe they fill up to 40% of the bench.
Yeah, so that feels like a really overwhelming, like, slam dunk for the people who want the bench to be more conservative, that they'd have this big proportion. Trump's appointing a bunch of people, there's records being broken. Is it as easy as all that? That's kind of what you looked at with your story. So hopefully you can help us sort of break down some of the things that might be stumbling blocks here.
Right, yeah. And there has been a lot written about this historic opportunity that he has. It may come yet come to pass that that he's able to accomplish this. But I think I was just interested that, when you look at the close up at the courts and where he's made appointments and where, which judges he's replacing, things get a little bit fuzzier.
Well, and your story illustrated that, right, with the story of the D.C. Circuit. So let's zoom in on that court and sort of explain, how some of these challenges can be illustrated in that court.
Sure. So, obviously the D.C. Circuit's very important in terms of, challenges to government, federal government authority. Mm-hmm. And right now there's a Democratic majority that was pretty much sealed by President Obama. And, I guess Republicans can look at that as a court they'd like to, in a sense, win back. And there would be potentially an opportunity to do that. There's seven Democratic appointed judges who are on active duty now, mm-hmm. four Republicans. And but three of those Democrats are eligible for senior status, and so
on paper it looks like a flippable court.
If they if they were to step down and Trump were to appoint their replacements, the court would flip. But big question is those are three Clinton appointees, and I guess experts say there's no chance they're going to step down anytime soon. I mean,
right.
Should be pointed out that one of them is the Chief Judge, Merrick Garland.
Merrick Garland, where have I heard that name before?
I don't know.
I can't remember.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like someone who would want to be like, Trump appoint someone to replace
him. Definitely.
No, thank you.
Definitely.
Yeah. So that does set up the idea that there is some bit of sort of luck to this, that they have to get lucky with the right people retiring so that they have these appointments available to them.
In a sense, yes. I mean, a lot of the judges who have taken senior status or have announced their plans to take senior status now are, they're Republican appointees. I think the mix is around about 100 Republican appointees to about 60 Democratic appointees. So, Trump administration has to fill those slots, and if they're filling Republican-appointed seats, they're not necessarily, in a sense, gaining ground.
And the other big thing looming over all of this is the midterm elections, which are coming up in a few months and could really, really slow things down.
Right. I mean, as everyone knows, the GOP controls 51 seats in the Senate now, and should they lose any of those seats in some of the potentially close battles in November, that could really put a stop to their judicial ambitions.
Well, you have to think, after what we saw in the last 2 years of the Obama administration, you can't think if the Democrats take the Senate back that they're going to be really eager to work quickly on any of these nominees, right?
Yeah, it seems like there's a fair amount of bad blood now.
Yeah.
So it sounds like coming into this segment, and before I read your story, I just really thought we've had this blitz of nominations and this record number of circuit appointments.
It feels like one of the only things, right, that like a lot of things have been dysfunctional in the first year of the Trump
administration, really,
but this has been a real big accomplishment, right?
But now, I'm not so sure, Ed. It sounds like the rest of the road to really push the judiciary is going to be a tough one.
It certainly will be.
Yeah, we'll be watching out. Thanks for coming on, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard all about how many judges Trump has been able to get confirmed in his first year in office. But one crucially important district hasn't gotten the same kind of attention. Here to discuss is senior reporter Jimmy Hoover, who wrote a great story on the struggles of the Central District of California. Welcome, Jimmy.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on the show. Can you explain what's happening in California as the Trump administration's been on a spree of getting judges confirmed everywhere else?
Sure. Yeah. In California, as in several other states with Democratic senators, there have been no nominees to the federal bench at the district court level from the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a particular problem in the Central District, seeing as though it's the largest and most populous, I wouldn't say geographically largest, it's the most populous federal district court in the country, with 19 million people in that jurisdiction.
Right, because that's
LA,
LA,
right?
Yeah,
that's LA. It's got San Bernardino County and Santa Ana. It's a huge swath of the state,
right,
around Los Angeles.
And that seems like a pretty big deal, because it must have a lot of tech cases and other high profile things going on there.
A lot of entertainment cases. I can speak to that.
Sure.
Yeah. So your story was about how there haven't been any. There haven't been any judges nominated for this district, and that there's a lot of seats. How bad are we talking here in terms of the situation in the Central District?
Sure. Well, there are currently 6 judicial vacancies, mm-hmm. Meaning that the at full capacity, it would go up to 28 full-time permanent judges. There are currently only 22. So what I've heard from people, both judges and litigators in the district, is that it's put a tremendous strain on the resources of the court, where you have judges hearing a large volume of cases that as you just mentioned are quite complex and can take a long time to dispense with, just because of the you know, heavy motions practice and everything like that. And so there's a large backlog that you see happening in the Central District of California where people are having trouble scheduling jury trials. Judges are taking, you know, motions under advisement when otherwise they would be, you know, hearing oral arguments on the questions. And there's just a general level of burnout where, you know, instead of taking senior status, you see a lot of judges going into private mediation, etc. So everyone pretty much recognizes that there's a massive problem here.
So this sounds like it's gotten pretty terrible there. And it seems like everyone pretty much agrees that the system's really overburdened and some of these seats should be filled. So what's going on? Why hasn't the Trump administration pushed to do that?
Well, I think what we've seen so far is that the Trump administration has been focusing on filling federal district court seats in predominantly Republican states with two Republican senators. And they've also shown a priority for naming judges to the appellate bench, as, you know, those are the judges that are very influential and can sometimes, you know, be the last word on a case because a lot of cases don't get resolved by the Supreme Court, as we know. Whereas the federal district court judges are kind of in the trenches handling the majority of litigation that goes on in the federal judiciary.
Is it just that those seats in Republican-controlled states are lower-hanging fruit? Is that it's an easier place to, you know, score a confirmation?
Well, that's the way that some people familiar with the process have described it. As you may know, there is this thing called the blue slip process that is still somewhat in existence in the Senate, where in order to confirm a district judge nominee, you have to have the sign-off from both of the home state senators. In the case of, you know, Democratic states, that means that both Democrats have to, you know, return their blue slips to the Senate so that the nominee can get passed, which means that, you know, the Trump White House in this case would have to kind of capitulate and honor the intentions and, you know, the preferences of these lawmakers who otherwise they pretty much disagree with.
So can we expect California's congressional delegation to push for some reinforcements coming up? I mean, is Dianne Feinstein gonna sort of push the issue and get some nominees for the Central District?
So California, like many other states, has judicial advisory commissions made up of local attorneys that help with the process. And so technically, it's kind of a nonpartisan process where you don't see a lot of involvement from the senators in the beginning. But what's notable is that we haven't heard anything. And I've reached out to Senator Feinstein, who is the ranking member on the Judiciary Committee, mm-hmm. and Senator Kamala Harris, who is the newest member of the Judiciary Committee. And none of them were able to get back to me and tell me where the status of things were. And the commissions, for their part, have not been returning any requests for comment, which begs the question of what is happening and what is causing this delay. Now, some have speculated that one of the delays is just the kind of political predicament that of this situation where you have, you know, a Democratic Party that's currently very reluctant to handing President Donald Trump you know, lifetime appointments to the federal bench when the judiciary so far has improved a very important backstop to some of the administration's more controversial political agenda.
Jimmy, this has been so interesting to hear about how Trump has been appointing a lot of people, but there's still districts like the Central District of California that remain stymied. Thanks for explaining it all to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That'll wrap up our show today. Guys, we're going to end it here because we had so much to pack in. We're not going to get to an off.
A lot of trade talk.
Jeez, right across my bow. Yeah, a little bloated today, just like me. I'm going to get out of here.
Yeah, thanks for being with me, Alex.
Cool.
And Bill.
See you again next week, guys.
We also want to thank our guests this week, Ed Beeson and Jimmy Hoover, and our contributing reporter, Sam Reisman, and our producers, Kelly Marcano and Steven Trader. Music for the show this week comes from Silent Partner and Little Glass Men. If you want to know more about any of the things we've talked about today, check out our website at law360.com/podcast. If you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps others find the show. Thanks, and join us again next week.